Good evening, listeners and students of Hitler's Table Talk. It is July 31st, 2014, and we are bringing you Adolf Hitler's lunch and supper table conversations from January 17th to the 22nd, or maybe the 24th, 1942, at the military headquarters of the Führer. By we, I mean myself, Carolyn Jaeger.
And me, Ray Goodwin.
And Ray, you know, last week we enjoyed the many stories about Adolf Hitler and his National Socialist early days at Berchtesgaden and over Salzburg. And tonight we have him telling us some more old stories about his little dog that he found and kept with him on the front lines during World War One.
Right.
I imagine you enjoyed that as much as I did.
I certainly did.
I've even got looked up the pictures of him and his some pictures that were taken of some of his fellow regiment comrades, and the little dog is in there, little terrier. Obviously, it's a British dog. Probably came from the British side. At least I think he even kind of intimates that, but he took it and made it German. As I was looking for pictures of that, I came across a website where I said, whoops, it's a blog, starts with two A's. I've seen it before, and I didn't know it was so anti-Hitler. At least it had an article about and a picture of Hitler and his dog, and so nasty, so hateful, you know, just pointing out that the dog didn't really like Hitler, that Hitler, because in some of the pictures he's sitting on the lap of a different, you know, one of the other men. Hitler did mention that he was sort of the company dog, but he had made himself Adolf's dog over and above everybody else. And he wouldn't leave, he, you know, stuck with him all the time. And
right.
I can believe that because I had a dog like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you get, I think dogs pick out, I'm talking about this before we even get to it. Mm-hmm. But here dogs pick out, you know, they do pick out who their one owner is, you know, and
sure.
The one that they're loyal to, and even though they're nice with other people, they're going to stick with that one. And I had experiences so similar to that, to what he talked about. And then this person even went on to say that one of the men, Ernst Schmidt, in the picture had written about how he slept with Adolf Hitler and Adolf Hitler was gay and on and on. Anyway, I thought, what is this baloney, you know, that you run into? It's so nasty. They just can't stand it.
Mm-hmm.
People to, they just have to tear Adolf Hitler down to the extreme.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we'll be coming up to that. I thought I just had that stuck in me. I guess I had to say something about it. So I'm ready to have you start if you're ready. I don't have even anything to interrupt you with at the beginning here.
All righty, we shall get started with the night of 17th and 18th of January 1942. First of all, snow, later frost. That's all one could read in the books about Russia. And Hilger himself has no more to tell. It's a proof that one can't trust all these observations. It's obviously easy to calculate the average temperatures based on the results over several years, but it would be indispensable to add that in some years the variations in temperature can be greater and far greater than the calculated averages allow one to suppose.
You know, I'm going to just mention here that when he says, first of all, snow, later frost, you know, I have noticed that in German, they use, instead of freeze, they say frost. And I think that frost to me, as an American, I think of Jack Frost, you know.
Yeah.
Or I think of kind of a light frost, you know. I just think of the first frost and so on, not a deep freeze. But I think they use that word frost for freeze. Or it's translated. It's always being translated that way. So, go ahead.
I was going to say it makes more sense.
Yeah.
The German, because you think of frostbite, The frost that we see out on the lawn or whatever is not going to eat your toes off or whatever.
No.
But if you consider frost, as the Germans did, a term for freeze or frozen, then it makes mm-hmm. sense.
Yeah, and that's why it says it that way.
Mm-hmm. The staggering blow for us was that the situation was entirely unexpected, and the fact that our men were not equipped for temperatures they had to face. Moreover, our command could not at once adapt its tactics to the new conditions. Nowadays, we allow the Russians to infiltrate whilst we remain where we are without budging. They get themselves wiped out behind our lines, or else they gradually wither away in the villages for lack of supplies. It takes solid nerves to practice such tactics. I can even say openly that my respected predecessor had not the nerves required for that. Generals must be tough, pitiless men, as crabbed as mastiffs, cross-grained men such as I have in the party. Those are the sort of soldiers who impose their will on such a situation. If the frost hadn't come, we'd have gone on careering forward 600 kilometers in some places. We were within a hair's breadth of it. Providence intervened and spared us a catastrophe. The oil we needed at that moment, we already had. And all we needed was this intervention. The idiot who bestowed that all temperatures oil on us. I hate those specialist jobs. I regard everything that comes from a theoretician as null and void. Aesthetical forms, mechanical finish, let's keep these preoccupations for peacetime. What I need at this moment are locomotives that will stand the grind for 5 or 6 years. All these details, which result in a machine remaining on record for another 10 years, are a matter of complete indifference to me. Recently, one of our new Messerschmitts fell into enemy hands. They were dumbfounded. An American magazine wrote that the opinion was widespread that the Germans had only mediocre material, but that it was necessary to yield to the evidence that within 3 years at least, the United States would not be able to produce an aircraft of that quality. To oppose it with the aircraft at present service, it added, would be to send our pilots to suicide. It must be observed, while we're on the subject, that a German aircraft requires at least 6 times as much work as an American aircraft. The Italian fighters, too, are superior to the Hurricanes.
Now I'm going to interrupt right here.
Yeah.
You think that's right, what he's saying about the German aircraft?
Yes.
Versus the American aircraft? I thought the Americans came along with real good planes.
No, there was technology on both sides. When I say both sides, I mean the Japanese and the Germans. When the American fighters in the Pacific went up against the Japanese Zero, they were outclassed totally. And they were very, very much getting beaten in every encounter because the Zero could accelerate faster, climb higher than the American fighters that they had in the Pacific at the time. So there had to be some diligent work in our labs back in the United States and our factories to come up with a fighter that could stay with the Japanese Zero. And it was the same in Europe with the Messerschmitt, that the quality of that airplane the Germans had was higher than what we had. And it did take us a couple of years to catch up.
Yeah. Well, I know reading that we started out with some, the Germans' planes started out being better, but then there were new models of both the British and the Americans that did better than what the Germans had.
That's true.
In some respects, anyway.
Yeah.
And now, what about the Hurricanes? Weren't the Hurricanes the British planes?
Yes, that's
and
right.
And the Italian planes were superior? I thought those Hurricanes were pretty good.
Yeah, I did too, and that kind of surprised me because I didn't know the quality of the Italian fighters that they were using at all.
Maybe,
I didn't know anything.
Maybe that's
about
wishful thinking on his part, or maybe he's speaking too soon. I don't know.
Yeah.
But weren't the Hurricanes some of the later models that the British came up with?
Yeah.
It's a fighter. It was a fighter that that one they had before that. This was supposed to be better than that one. What's that one called? So well known. I can't think of it.
I think it was the SPAD, as they call it, a SPAD. I believe that may have been.
No, I'm the British? I don't know. I never heard of that.
I don't remember.
The mosquito, I guess, I'm thinking of.
Oh, yeah.
Is the mosquito similar to the hurricane or not at all?
You know, I don't know.
Oh, I don't either. So.
I don't know.
And since we're stopped here, let me go back a little bit to, when he says my predecessor.
Yes.
My respected predecessor didn't have the nerve required for that. I wonder if he's speaking about Halder there.
Well,
Halder
to me,
was
he,
general in charge.
I thought that he was speaking of Hindenburg, but and the tactics that were used in World War I when they were fighting the Russians, and that's the way I took it. You may be right.
Wow, I never even thought that at all.
He said my respected predecessor. So to me it was Hindenburg.
But he's talking about letting the Russians infiltrate behind their lines and then wiping them out there. Well, it's kind of dangerous, I guess he thought. And so I don't know if he's talking about Hindenburg in that respect, because when I was looking for these for pictures, I found some really good pictures of the Germans in this very cold winter. There was a bunch of them on this one page I had never seen before. And it said there, they had some pictures of some dead bodies and in the snow and all, and they said these were Red Army soldiers that had come behind the lines, and they got caught back there, and they mowed them down. Boy, they had some German and Russian bodies found here and there, and boy, it looked horrible because it was just so frozen. The temperatures were so low, and this was around Moscow too.
Oh yeah,
pictures
yeah.
said so. Yeah, well. All right, that's all I wanted to say.
Well, while we're back there, let me just say that when Hitler says the staggering blow for us was that the situation was entirely unexpected, meaning that record-setting winter blast, and he said our men were not equipped for the temperatures they had to face. And, you know, I have always been of the notion that that cold stopped the German offensive. And had they not been stopped, they would have captured Moscow. When what he says right here leads you to believe otherwise, he said that they were, in essence, spread so far, so thin, their supply lines were so thin, and their advanced forces were so far ahead of the main force, you might say, that they were in grave danger of being totally cut off. And he said, had it not been for that icy blast stopping our advance, he says it was Providence intervened and spared us a catastrophe.
I know, and this is not the first time he said this. He said this a couple other times that we've read. So, I had never heard this before either. Now, either he's trying to make the best of it. I'm always suspicious. Or it's true, because if they were moving into Moscow, you wouldn't think they'd get so far ahead. Well, he was talking about other places going too far ahead. So where they would get their supply lines wouldn't be able to keep up with them, I guess, because he's saying that, you know, as difficult as it was, it was a providential.
Yes. Yes. And then he makes that remark that...
Well, I'd like to hear, you know... We have comments from Jodl, and not too much from Keitel. Jodl was more forthcoming when they were questioning him at Nuremberg and stuff. I'd like to hear some other opinions on that, whether anybody else thought that. I'm sure it couldn't have been just Hitler all by himself thinking that. But
yeah.
Like you say, it's not something that you come upon very often.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think he took a slap at his technicians back home when... And I think he was being entirely facetious when he said, the oil we needed at that moment, we already had, and all we needed was this intervention. The idiot who bestowed that all temperatures oil on us. I hate those specialist jobs, and I regard everything that comes from a theoretician as null and void. In other words, his technicians back home had shipped a bunch of this oil to the front as all temperature oil, which proceeded to freeze up in record cold, you know. And so he was being, I think he was being facetious when he said the oil we needed at the moment we already had, but certainly they didn't.
And, okay, if they needed something different.
Yeah. So anyway, moving on, at Malta, our tactics consist in attacking without respite so that the English are compelled to keep on firing without interruption. The Italians have just launched another torpedo attack on the harbor of Alexandria. In the opinion of the English, these attacks are the work of very brave men. What we've just experienced in Russia, because of the weather, the sort of upset that leaves you groggy for a moment, is something the Italians experienced before us. As a result of the serious mistakes they made in the employment of their forces, we recovered from it quickly, but will they recover?
Well, now, what is he speaking about here? And here he admits that it was a pretty bad upset. It was pretty disturbing and distressing, this cold weather thing. It wasn't something in it. And then later he looks and he says, well, maybe this is providential. He did that about a number of things that were bad news. And I think one was when the British and French declared war on him after the September 1st in entry into Poland, and they didn't expect that. And then later he said, "Well, this is working out all right because seeing things all for the best." But here, then he says that he's talking about the Italians, and they made a similar mistake, but will they recover? What's he talking about, you know?
You know, I went over and over in my mind about that, and I never could come up with a valid answer, because the Italians certainly didn't beat the Germans' forces into Russia and, you know, on the front with them. There may have been some. So I tried my best to think of, had I heard any history of Italian forces fighting in very, very cold areas, and there were none. Because, you know, the only familiarity I have with the Italian military is in Africa.
He must not be meaning the cold. He must be meaning something else.
That's all I could come up with.
That they ran into. And it seems to be kind of current because he says, will they recover? Well, these are the kind of things that you just don't have any help with.
Well, you know, excuse me, Carolyn, but an idea there when he says, we recovered from it quickly, but will they recover? So apparently the Italians were still in that sort of thing. And perhaps it was the sandstorms that they encountered in the desert warfare with the British in North Africa. And perhaps their equipment and troops bogged down with the sand or something like that. What, you know, he said the deployment of their forces, they made a lot of mistakes. I think you're right. I don't think it has a thing to do with the cold.
And then he says, we recovered from it quickly. I don't know about that.
Right.
Because
it
did have a very negative impact.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay.
So
I've got a bit of criticism for Hitler tonight. Especially when we get into the food thing again, I don't think he makes much sense some of the times when he's talking about the food. So we'll wait till we get there.
All righty. Okay. 18th of January, 1942, the evening. My whole life can be summed up as this ceaseless effort of mine to persuade other people. In 1932, I had a conversation at the Kaiserhof with Meissner. He told me that if he was a Democrat, it was in a perhaps slightly different way than we imagined, and that, in fact, we weren't so far removed from one another. He promised me that, in any case, he would do what he could for me with Field Marshal Hindenburg. It won't be easy, he added, for the old gentleman's habits of thinking and feeling are in revolt against all you represent. I must recognize that Meissner was the first man who made me understand Hindenburg's exact situation. In whom could the field marshal find support? In any case, not among the German nationalists, who were a lot of incompetents. He was not disposed to violate the Constitution. So what could we do? It required a great effort from him to collaborate with certain social democrats and certain representatives of the center. He also had an aversion for Hugenberg, who had one day described him as a traitor for having maintained Meissner in his job. Hindenburg invited me. Herr Hitler, I wish to hear from your own mouth a summary of your ideas. It is almost impossible across such a gap to communicate to others one's own conception of the world. I tried to establish contact with the field marshal by having recourse to comparisons of a military nature. Connection was fairly rapidly made with the soldier, but the difficulty began the instant there was a question of extending our dawning comprehension to politics. When I'd finished my summary, I felt that I'd moved Hindenburg and that he was yielding. At once, he made this a pretext for reproaching me with an incident that had occurred in East Prussia. But your young people have no right to behave as they do. Not long ago, at Tannenberg, they shouted out so that I could hear, "Wake up, wake up," and yet I'm not asleep. Certain charitable souls had given the old gentleman to suppose that the shout was meant for him personally, whereas in reality our supporters were shouting, "Wake up, Germany! Deutschland erwache!" a Nazi slogan. Shortly after this interview, Hindenburg informed me that he would consult me whenever there was a decision to take. But the influence of the enemies I numbered amongst those about me remained so strong that even in 1933 I couldn't see him except in the presence of Papen.
Yeah, and I think that's pronounced Papen.
Papen, okay. Mm-hmm. One day, Papen being absent, I appeared in the field marshal's presence by myself. "Why is Herr von Papen always with you?" he asked. "But it is you I want to talk to." When Papen came back, he must have regretted the trip that had called him away. The old gentleman regarded Papen as a sort of greyhound, but I think he was fond of him. Papen knew admirably how to handle him. We owe a debt of gratitude to Papen, by the way, for it was he who opened the first breach in the sacred Constitution. It's obvious one couldn't expect more from him than that. Unless Antonescu gains the ear of the people, he's undone. The commander, who has no troops behind him, cannot maintain himself for long. It's thanks to the People's Party that Ataturk assured his rule. It's the same thing in Italy. If Antonescu were to disappear today, there would be a terrible struggle in the army between the claimants to his succession. That wouldn't happen if there were an organization that could impose his successor. In his place, I'd have made the Legion the basis of power after first shooting Horia Sima.
Now, what do you know about Horia Sima? Because I looked him up. And it seems that Hitler's saying he doesn't think much of him.
Yeah, I didn't find much on him myself. It's just that you know he's made remarks during our study all along about Antonescu being the only man in Romania or something like that. You know, he really admired him, and then he said if Antonescu were deposed or anything. He said, in his place, I would have made the Legion the basis of power. Mm-hmm. And that was Corneliu Codrino's unit, the Legion.
Mm-hmm.
That was very pro-National Socialist organization. But but he said, after first shooting this Sima fellow,
yeah.
I don't know what
Sima was like Codrino's second man or something. He became the commander of the Legion after Codrino, who was the founder and leader of the Iron Guard, was imprisoned. Tension built. And I don't think Codrino ever got out of prison, did he? I mean, somehow he was killed or something. He died pretty young. I don't know his story exactly. But so this it says. This is from Wikipedia. Tension built following a series of assassinations of Iron Guard members, including Code Renault, who was killed in prison. There it is right there. In late November 1938. So there was maybe there was some infiltration in there. Maybe they were just fighting amongst one another. I don't know. But this was in 38. And so Sima was imprisoned in Germany, but he was released in August 1944 to build a pro-National Socialist puppet government in exile. In 44, and then other things happened. But he did live until 1993 in Spain.
Wow.
But obviously,
Hitler didn't think much of him.
No, and the National Socialists didn't. They had him, you know, in a camp for a while, and him doing different things, mm-hmm. and they'd let him come out and do things for them. But he seemed like he did believe in it, but I don't know what the problem. I really couldn't figure out from what I read what the problem with him was.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting though. Sidelight.
Sure.
Maybe it just shows that. That those Romanians can't hold it together the way the German National Socialists were. They couldn't hold their movement together without a lot of infighting and problems and so on. But Antonescu was a military man.
Mm-hmm.
Different.
Yeah, and that's kind of what Hitler suggested all along when he would mention the Romanians, you know?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So that's the impression that I had of them myself. Okay, he says, without a solid political basis, it's not possible either to settle a question of succession or to guarantee the normal administration of the state. From this point of view, the Romanians are in a state of inferiority in relation to the Hungarians. The Hungarian state has the advantages of a parliament. For us, such a thing would be intolerable, but theirs is one whose executive power is, in practice, independent.
See, there he's saying that their problem of the Romanians and the Iron Guard and so on was that they didn't have a solid political base.
Mm-hmm.
Or they didn't have a state administration.
That's right.
That kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the Hungarians do.
Right.
And it's also interesting here, he's going back to Papen. You know, now I'm wondering if it is Papen. I think it seems like I've heard that a lot, but I thought the A, but it doesn't have the umlaut in front of it, so maybe it's, I don't know.
Papen or Poppen. Yep. Papen is what?
Papen. Maybe, yeah, it's probably Papen. I don't know why I said, I got confused. Sorry, I'm
that's all right.
Confused tonight. But he says, but he's doing some more reminiscing here about
yes,
the early days. So
that's exactly right.
That.
And that's why he says Papen's misfortune was that he had no support. We were not strong enough to shore him up. Anyway, I wouldn't have done it, for Papen was not our man. The sum total of the deficits of the Reich and the German states was reaching the yearly figure of 5,500 millions. On top of that, we had to pay 5,000 millions to our enemies. Marvelous result, Papen said to me after his return from Geneva, speaking of the 150,000 millions that appeared on paper. With that, on the 30th of January, we'll have 83 millions in the Reich's vaults. Then we had the following dialogue. With what do you propose to pay? But we'll have to pay, otherwise they'll make us go bankrupt.
Yeah, and that's Papen saying.
Yes.
Oh, we'll have to.
Yeah. How will they do that? They have nothing to distrain on. When I demanded 3,000 millions for rearmament, I again met this objection of what we owed abroad. I replied, you want to give this money to foreigners? Let's rather use it in our own country. I made my point of view clear to the British ambassador when he presented his credentials. His reply was, you mean to say that the new Germany does not recognize the obligations of preceding governments? I replied, freely negotiated arguments, yes.
Agreements.
But blackmail, no. Everything that comes under the heading of Treaty of Versailles, I regard as extortion. Well, I never, he said. I shall immediately inform my government of that. Never again from that day on did England or France think themselves entitled to claim the smallest payment from us. As regards the English, I had no worries, but I feared that the French might take this pretext for occupying Mainz, for example.
Well, I don't know if they did or not, but I don't think so.
No. And but you know, that little section right there, that Treaty of Versailles, and anybody that studied it at all knows what an extortionist piece of junk it was. And of course, the big money powers and all had to saddle Germany with reparations that were just impossible to pay. And besides being totally unjust, totally unfair, and they came up with it, assigning Germany the responsibility of the war and saddling them with, you have to pay the reparations.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Treaty of Versailles was, in my opinion, what caused World War II, because it was such an unjust settlement mm-hmm. of World War I. It allowed the French to march into the Ruhr Valley and to take control of the German coal mines and ship a lot of coal back into France in the record-setting winter that was 1919. And so many Germans froze to death. They'd go to get the coal, and the French would tell them, "Hell no, they sent it back to France," and things like this. And so,
oh yeah, it was like really just as mean as they
yes.
could be, and humiliation, and also I can't think of the word, like a kind of a torture. Let's just
yes.
keep stepping on these people
mm-hmm.
as much as we can. That was the attitude of the French.
Oh, and the French, they not only did that, but they brought in colonial, meaning colored, troops from their territories that they had to occupy parts of Germany. And those colored troops were given the freedom or leeway without fear of punishment to assault the German civilians as they saw fit. And that included rape and other crimes. And so, you know, when the Germans hauled off and hit the French with both fists just a few years later, it was certainly, to my mind, justified
mm-hmm.
in every meaning of the word.
Yeah, and
what
you know,
the French had done.
And you know, it shows that Hitler was the right man at that time, because look at everybody else is saying, "Oh, we have to pay this." Oh, and,
yes.
and Papen was so happy because he had gotten it renegotiated. He was part of that group that went along with that renegotiation. And well, Hitler talked about this once before. We've already read it earlier. It was, but they didn't gain anything. They gained time. It was reduced because it was put for over a longer period of time
That's right.
They had to pay it. And they thought Germans were going along with that. So they just stay in debt forever and ever and ever, you know. And for him, he just cut that thing off. And what did anybody do about it? Nothing.
Because yeah. they knew it was unjust.
That's right. And they knew there was nothing they could do. So that was one of the first brilliant things that he did. It was
mm-hmm.
very, very good.
And a lot of that fell under, as far as the United States part on that, Carolyn, was the Dawes plan. There was that. The Germans were begging and pleading for relief because they were being bled dry. They couldn't make their reparations payments. And so the United States sends Dawes over there to make this deal, which is exactly what you just said. And the American people, a lot of them were in sympathy with Germany because they were being treated that way. And so Dawes goes over there. And he draws up this plan and says, "Boy, we're gonna step in here because we agree that Germany is kind of being pushed around here. So let's take a look at these reparations payments." And so it was like he came back saying, "We've given them some relief," which is all they did was reduce the payments, certainly, and he could just flaunt that from the hilltops, and yet he extended them over a period of time to where they meant they were the same amount.
Yeah.
You know, it would just put it on them for a longer period of time.
Right.
And it was under the pretext of helping Germany at that time. But it was all false.
Right. So now we're going to the night of 18th and 19th, and there's a timeline item of the war, and that on the 19th, Japanese forces take large numbers of British troops prisoner north of Singapore.
Mm-hmm.
That's all.
Yep, and that advance continues all the way around Borneo and towards Australia. So that's an important point.
Mm.
Okay, the night of the 18th and 19th of January, 1942. I'm sometimes asked why I don't modify the party program, to which I reply, and why should I modify it? This program belongs to history. It was already ours on the day of the foundation of the party, on the 24th February, 1919. If anything should be changed, it's for life to take the initiative. I haven't got to identify myself with a medical review or a military publication, things which have to present matters under discussion in their latest state. What luck for governments that the peoples they administer don't think. The thinking is done by the man who gives the orders, and then by the man who carries them out. If it were otherwise, the state of society would be impossible. The difficulty of the situation is not so much the winter in itself, but the fact of having men and not knowing how to transport them, of disposing abundantly of ammunition and not knowing how to get it on the move, of possessing all the necessary weapons and not knowing how to put them in the hands of the combatants. As for the railways, I'm keeping them behind. If they don't do better next time, I'll have a word to say to them. All the same, it's better that it should be I who speaks on the 30th and not Goebbels. When it's a question of raising morale, I know how to preserve the golden mean between reason and rhetoric. In his last appeal, Goebbels exhorted the soldiers at the front to remain tough and calm. I'd not have expressed myself like that. In such a situation, the soldier is not calm, but resolved. One must have been through it to understand these matters. A skull is dug up by chance, and everybody exclaims, "That's what our ancestors were like." Who knows if the so-called Neanderthal man wasn't really an ape? What I can say in any case is that it wasn't, our ancestors who lived there in prehistoric times. The soil we live on must have been so desolate that our ancestors, if they passed that way, certainly continued their journey. When we're asked about our ancestors, we should always point to the Greeks.
Yeah.
So.
You know what? I just noticed that the stream left is 20 minutes, which means that this show got scheduled for an hour for somehow.
Okay.
But we can still go over. Ignore it. We'll just ignore when she comes to that and continue as long as we want, you know, and then play the music, because I have to play the music by hand anyway. But I think what happened was there was a bunch of them scheduled, and I just took they had all the same information on them, and I just took the next one coming up, and I must not have changed the length of the show. That has to be what happened. I was just surprised to see that. So, okay, just to let you know, when we hear that that woman saying we've got so many seconds or something.
Sure. Okay, I appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
19th of January, 1942, evening. I've always had a lot of trouble in stopping my men from fighting duels. In the end, I was forced to forbid dueling. We lost some of our best people in that stupid fashion. Just try to imagine the reasons for some of these duels. One day, we were at the Reichsadler. Hess was there with his wife and sister-in-law. In comes a half-drunk student who permits himself to make some impertinent remarks about them. Hess asked them to come out of the inn with him and clarify his views. Next day, two hobbledehoys come to see Hess and ask him to explain the insult to their comrade. I forbade Hess to become involved in this ridiculous affair, and I asked him to send me the 2 seconds. I said to them, "You're trying to pick a quarrel with a man who fought against the enemy for 4 years. Aren't you ashamed?" Our friend Holzschuher was involved in an affair that might have ended in a duel. The pretext was grotesque. I said to the people concerned, "I know some communist hideouts where, for any of our chaps, the mere fact of showing oneself is to risk one's life. If any of us is tired of living, let him go and make a trip around those places. I've never known a single case of a duel that deserved to be taken seriously. We had an irreparable loss in Strunk, our only journalist in the international class. His wife was insulted. He was killed. Where's the logic? In 1923, Dietrich Eckert was simultaneously challenged to a duel by 16 or 17 flabby adolescents. I intervened and put the whole affair in good order. In my presence, nobody turned a hair. Obviously, there are cases in which two individuals have a conflict that no tribunal could settle. Let's assume they quarrel over a woman. A solution must be found. One of the two has got to disappear. But in time of war, there's no question of condoning affairs of that kind. The country can't afford such superfluous deaths. For peasants' brawls, I'm inclined to be extremely indulgent. The young man whose honor is in question can no longer show himself in the village unless he's fought for his sweetheart. There's nothing tragic in affairs of that sort. And sometimes it sometimes happens that a court finds a man guilty of murder when he's really only a culpable homicide. It's sufficient if the accused has once in bravado threatened to kill the other man. Then, at once, people wish to interpret the act as the execution of a well-considered plan. What would happen if all those who have offered threats of this sort in the country areas were regarded as murderers? In such cases, and when I see that the accused is a decent lad, I wink an eye. The penalty is first of all commuted into imprisonment. After some time, it becomes conditional liberation. Who in Germany is allowed to see justice done for himself, even on a point of honor? I don't see that honor. I don't see that honor is the privilege of a caste. Yeah. If the labor front demanded that its members should have the right to duel, there'd soon be nobody left in Germany except abortions with no sense of honor. In principle, I'd be inclined to permit dueling between priests and between lawyers. For decent people, there are more noble and more effective ways of serving one's country. In this sphere, it's time to impose a scale of values that has some relation to reality. In comparison with the important things of life, these incidents seem mere trifles. How many families are wearing black because of this ridiculous practice? Besides, it proves nothing. In dueling, what matters is not to have right on your side, but to aim better than your opponent.
Well, that's pretty good sense there, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you think of these little points of honor, somebody insults somebody else. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, I don't know, maybe I read this in books or something. Someone would just want to start something with another person. They'd walk up to them and, you know, slap them in the face with their gloves,
right,
or something.
Yes.
And then that other person was duty-bound, honor-bound to say, well, I'll meet you at dawn tomorrow. And
yeah,
then they go and, you know, have this shootout. Sometimes, though, it didn't end up in tragedy because they'd both miss and then they'd all go home or something like that. But, yeah, it's pretty, it should be outlawed. I agree.
To, you know, to pay for such a triviality with a life,
mm-hmm,
is totally absurd. And
And
you know, throughout the history of my part of the country and over to the east of us through parts of the south, there was that supposed code of honor with dueling taking place. It wasn't as prevalent down here as it was where you had an elite, you know, you might call them the upper class or the mm-hmm, aristocracy, who had this code about defending your honor, and if it takes a life, it takes a life. But that didn't last very long down here. It evolved to fisticuffs. You know, if a guy got insulted, it was fight it out, and whoever whipped the other one with his fist, then that settled it, and they went on. You know,
yeah,
no death paid for it.
Yeah, it makes more sense.
Yeah. Okay, we'll move to the 20th of January, 1942.
Yeah, and of course that is the Wannsee Conference in Berlin on the 20th of January, 1942.
Mm-hmm.
And that caused me that, you know, I'm not going to talk about it. It's just mentioned. that took place then and is taking place now. It caused me to realize that there's many important dates involving National Socialism that fall on the 20th of the month. Number one, Adolf Hitler's birthday.
Correct.
And the Valkyrie plot was July 20th. Mm-hmm. The Von C was January 20th. And I thought that I couldn't come up with any more right off the bat, but those are three important ones. Plus, then I thought, well, the whole National Socialist experience began and ended during the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another 20. It was filled up the 20th century, so to speak.
Now that is interesting, and you know, it missed only by a couple of days, but the launching of Barbarossa was the 22nd of June.
There you go.
Yeah. So, that's interesting.
Uh-huh.
20th of January, 1942, midday. Special guest, Reichsführer SS Himmler. In the old Imperial Army, the best rubbed shoulders with the worst. Both in the Navy and in the Army, everything was done to exclude the worker from the German community. And that's what gave rise to social democracy. This attitude did a lot of harm. The institution of the warrant officer doing an officer's job was a serious mistake. In every regiment, there are officers who are particularly gifted and therefore destined for a rapid promotion. Numerous warrant officers would have deserved to have the same chances of promotion, but their way was barred. The question of an NCO in the officer's caste being practically impossible. On the other hand, the more junior teacher could automatically become an officer. And what's a teacher? One must not generalize either to one effect or the other, and it's only when a man has proved himself that one knows whether he's worthy of command. If he is, then he must be given the prerogatives corresponding to his functions. The man who commands a company must necessarily have the rank of captain. It's due to him, if only to give him the authority he needs. Cases are not rare of warrant officers who had to command a company for more than 2 years, and of lieutenants who had to command a battalion. It's a duty towards the soldiers to give those who command them the rank that corresponds to their functions, assuming, of course, that they deserve it. But it's impermissible when a major has been put in command of a regiment to refuse him on grounds of sheer red tape the rank of colonel to which he's entitled. In peacetime, obviously, everything finds its proper level again. I distrust officers who have exaggeratedly theoretical minds. I'd like to know what becomes of their theories at the moment of action. In modern war, a company commander aged more than 40 is an absurdity. At the head of a company, one needs a man of about 26. At the head of a brigade, a man of about 35. At the head of a division, a man of 40. All these men are exaggeratedly old. From now on, I shall pay no attention to the table of seniority when it's a matter of assigning a post. And what that section right there, Carolyn, is just meritocracy all over again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, the way I understand it, that they had something called a warrant officer
mm-hmm.
that was doing a job that he was really not being given title for.
Yes.
And it was because these the Imperial Army, the old aristocratic type army, they didn't want commoners to be able to have these rank.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes they were good and they gave them the work to do. But they didn't give him the rank.
Yes.
And there again is Hitler standing up for these people and against this kind of tradition that they had where they were going to run everything. It was all theirs.
Sure. You know? And what he could, being a common soldier, mm-hmm. like all the rest of them, he could see right through that stuff. The men on the front lines could see that whenever a warrant officer of great talent was given a job to do and he did it. The higher-up said, okay, that's enough, go sit down, we'll take it from here, things like this. Mm-hmm. And the men could see through that, and they felt exactly like Hitler did.
Well, you know, now this sheds light for me on his feeling of, he said, and it's been said, that he turned down promotions when he was a soldier because he didn't want to be in the officer class. He wanted to stay with the, with his comrades, the ordinary soldiers. And I can see now that with this kind of thing, he knows that he would have been taken, excuse me, he would have lost maybe some of his camaraderie with his comrades there, and he didn't want to get into that, so he just stayed out of it. That's how little he cared about falsely presenting himself as something, somebody, you know, or getting ahead at whatever.
Right.
He was a real down-to-earth person, that's for sure.
And apparently he saw a lot of officers who were in over their heads, so to speak, that they didn't deserve to be where they were, and he wanted no part of that. Any promotion that put him up there with them, then in eyes of the,
a
common
really.
Soldier that didn't know him would think he just liked those guys, you know, there because of his bloodlines or whatever, not because he's earned it. So that was smart position for him to take.
Well, they were able to say from then on, all during his career, he was just the that old corporal, you know.
Oh, yeah.
But it didn't stop him. So it shows a lot of character that he had, in my opinion.
Yes, yes, I agree.
Oh, we have a timeline now, and it's January 21st. Rommel begins a surprising counteroffensive at El Agheila. It's in Africa. His troops with new reinforcements and tanks capture Agadabia. Then push north to Beta Fuam. So he's being in a successful period here, I guess. But I also wanted to say that there's going to be talk. You're going to be reading about the Czechs. And I just recalled when I was mentioning about the Wannsee Conference that took place on the 20th, and now it's the 22nd. But I could see that they would be talking about that because that corresponded with when the Czech government became officially under National Socialist control or something. I did a whole program on that. Now I can't even bring it to my mind what this was about. But Heydrich was there. They had a big ball, you know, it was a big ceremony. And then they had a big party, you know, a fancy ball type thing at the main government house in Prague. And the whole thing came together legally and so on for Germany to, and Heydrich played a big part in that, and that's part of the reason why it's questionable whether he could have also been at the Wannsee Conference on the 20th, because that all took place on the same day, and it was a day of heavy snow and cloudiness and bad weather and so on. So there's lots of questions about that. That whole Wannsee thing is screwed up, that whole story, but
right.
In any case, now that was dealing with the Czechs, and now that would probably fit in with why he's talking about the Czechs this
Correct.
Evening.
Yeah.
Well, this is midday.
Right, and just a little note here. You're going to hear phrases used by Hitler here in the next few pages that demonstrate that he was such a long-range thinker. He's going to say 200 years from now, this is going to be 100 years from now, and all. And he's referencing something that's very long-range in thought. And so, anyway, 22nd of January, midday, special guest, Reichsfuhrer SS Himmler and Gauleiter Rainer. It's not impossible that we may succeed by the end of 200 years of rule in solving the problem of nationalities. The problem was solved at the time of the outbreak of the 30 Years' War. About 1840, a Czech was ashamed of his language. His pride was to speak German. The summit of his pride was to be taken for a Viennese. The institution of universal suffrage in Austria was necessarily to lead to the collapse of German supremacy. As a matter of principle, the Social Democrats made common cause with the Czechs. The high aristocracy behaved in the same way. The German people are too intelligent for such fellows. They always had a preference for the backward peoples on the periphery. The Czechs were better than the Hungarians, Romanians, and Poles. There had grown up amongst them a hard-working and conscientious small bourgeoisie, quite aware of its limitations. Today they'll bow before us again with the same sense of mingled rage and admiration as before. People like us, people from Bohemia, are not predestined to rule, they used to say. With the habit of rule, one learns to command. The Czechs would probably have lost their inferiority complex by gradually observing their superiority to the other peoples who, like them, belong to the periphery of the empire of the Habsburgs. The situation before March 1939 is no longer conceivable. How was all that possible? After so many
centuries... Are you clear about what he's saying and all that? He's referring to a lot of things.
Yes, he is.
And it's hard to pick it all up as you're going along there because he doesn't say much about any of it. But he seems to be saying to me that that the Czechs were a very hardworking and conscientious national group, but they saw themselves as not up to the level of the Germans and accepted their position. Mm-hmm. In the empire as such.
Well, yeah, you're right. And to me, it also goes right back to the very first sentence where he says something about in solving the problem of nationalities. And if you have these nationalities clashing with each other, and actually none of them is capable of steering the ship, so to speak, or driving the locomotive, that's when Hitler talks about stepping in and saying, okay, the very best people are going to do this. You people are not cut out for it. And that's kind of how I took it, that, you know, he says something about Germans, 9 million Germans continue to rule the other
yeah.
50 million. So I think that's where he's going with it. Then these nationalities that were fighting with each other might have to back off.
He says the problem of the nationalities was solved at the time of the outbreak of the 30 Years' War.
Mm-hmm.
How was that done? I didn't get that. That's kind of enigmatic, and you'd have to he'd probably have to say more. You'd have to have more from him to understand what he means by that.
Yeah.
But anyway, I thought that was a religious thing. Maybe he means the problem of the nationalities has a lot to do with the difference between the Protestants and the Catholics, those who embrace Catholicism, those who embrace Protestants.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, we'll just go on because we don't have the answers exactly.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, after so many centuries of withdrawal, it's important that we should once again become aware of ourselves. We've already proved that we are capable of ruling peoples. Austria is the best example of it. If the Habsburgs hadn't linked themselves so closely to the outer elements of their empire, the 9 million Germans would have easily continued to rule the other 50 million. It's said that the Italians fight for the English. That's true, but it was just the same with us. In Austria, everybody fought for the Germans. The gift of command comes naturally to everyone in Lower Saxony. Wasn't it from there that Great Britain got its ruling class?
You know, I was gonna look that up on the map to make sure where he's talking, what he's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Saxony is below Brandenburg, kind of a little bit further to the west. It's kind of in the middle of Germany. If that says that's where the all those Brits come from.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, there's some Saxony has a reputation for not being very likable people. Well, what was it? I think in the beginning the Saxons in Saxony were very opposed to Hitler generally. But when they finally got on board and got turned around, then they were super
some of the best.
Yeah, some of the best. So that they are very That means they have a strong feelings about what they like. Mm-hmm. They're not indifferent.
Yeah. Thanks to its method of recruiting, the SS will be a nursery of rulers. In 100 years' time from now, we'll control this whole empire without having to rack our brains to know where to find the proper men. The essential thing is to leave behind the pettiness of the parochial spirit. That's why I'm so glad we're installed in Norway and all over the place. The Swiss are only suckers of the Germanic tree. We've lost some of our Germanics, the Berbers of North Africa, the Kurds of Asia Minor. One of them was Kemal Ataturk, who had nothing to do with his compatriots from the racial point of view.
Well, maybe so. I have no idea.
Mm-hmm. Nope.
But he's saying here that when he says Swiss are only suckers on the Germanic tree, I think he's just meaning that they're Germans. They've grown out of the, you know, the German trunk,
mm-hmm.
Just variations on Germans.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's kind of the way I took it, too. excuse me, 22nd of January, 1942, evening. Special guest, Admiral Fricke. Of all the areas of the Reich, it's Bavaria that used the proportionally to have the greatest number of seamen. The smallest bookshop in Munich used to display books about the Navy. The chief publisher of works on the Navy had his headquarters in Munich. I mean J.F. Lehmann. Germany consumes yearly an average of 12 kilograms of fish per head. In Japan, the average is from 50 to 60 kilos. We still have leeway to make up. To encourage the consumption of fish is above all a matter of organization and presentation, for it's essentially a perishable commodity. Before the First World War, it was incomparably easier to find fish in Munich than in Vienna, for example. It seems that since then, conditions in Austria have much improved. It's very difficult to persuade a cannibal not to eat human flesh. According to his ideas, it's a law of nature. Hitler turns toward Admiral Fricke. Above all, don't go believing that I'll issue a decree forbidding the Navy to eat meat. Supposing the prohibition of meat had been an article of faith for National Socialism, it's certain our movement wouldn't have succeeded. We would at once have been asked the question, then why was the leg of the calf created? At present, the base of our diet is the potato, and yet only 1% of the soil of Germany is devoted to growing the potato. If it was 3%, we'd have more to eat than is needed. Pasturages cover 37% of the surface of our country. So it's not man who eats grass, it's his cattle. Amongst the animals, those who are carnivores put up performances much inferior to those of the herbivores. A lion's in no shape to run for a quarter of an hour. The elephant can run for 8 hours. The monkeys, our ancestors of prehistoric times, are strictly vegetarian. Japanese wrestlers, who are amongst the strongest men in the world, feed exclusively on vegetables. The same is true of the Turkish porter, who can move a piano by himself. At the time when I ate meat, I used to sweat a lot. I used to drink 4 pots of beer and 6 bottles of water during a meeting, and I'd succeed in losing 9 pounds. When I became a vegetarian, a mouthful of water from time to time was enough. When you offer a child the choice of a piece of meat, an apple, or a cake, it's never the meat that he chooses. There's an ancestral instinct there. In the same way, the child would never begin to drink or smoke if it weren't to imitate others. The consumption of meat is reduced the moment the market presents a greater choice of vegetables, and in proportion as each man can afford the luxury of the first fruits. I suppose man became carnivorous because during the Ice Age, circumstances compelled him. They also prompted him to have his food cooked, a habit which, as one knows today, has harmful consequences. Our peasants never eat any food that hasn't been cooked and recooked and thus deprived of all its virtues. The southern peoples are not acquainted either with the meat diet or with cooking. I lived marvelously in Italy. I don't know any country that enlivens one more. Roman food, how delicious it is. Not long ago, I drank for the first time in my life a really good wine with an extraordinary bouquet. The drinkers with me said it was too sweet. I know people who seem normal and yet suddenly hurl themselves on drinks that on me have the effect of vitriol. If Hoffman were bitten by a serpent, I suppose the serpent would fall down stiff in a moment, dead drunk. When I go into an inn where people are smoking, within an hour I feel I've caught a cold. The microbes hurl themselves upon me. They find a favorable climate in the smoke and heat.
Well, so, you know, he was going on like this every so often on diet and health and so on. But all his listeners didn't care. It didn't change them one bit. They smoked. A whole lot of those men smoked, and they weren't going to give up their meat diet for anything that Hitler said. So it was kind of just like it still is that way among people. And actually, listening to you read this, I can't disagree with anything that he said, because I was kind of remembering him as saying that the lion couldn't run as fast as grass eating, but he was not saying that. He was saying he didn't have the endurance.
Yes.
He was talking about endurance because,
right.
You know, the big cats, they can run very fast, and they're meat eaters, and cattle are grass eaters, and they certainly can't run fast at all. So, you know, just depends on what you pick, but he wasn't talking about the speed anyway. He was talking about the
endurance. That's right.
So an elephant can run for 8 hours, is that right?
Well, apparently.
Well, he said so. I'm going to have to try to remember to look that up and check that out.
Mm-hmm.
But the one thing that he keeps bringing up, and this is the second time he said this, was that if you offer a child a choice of meat or apple or cake, well, he never chooses the meat. Well, a child wouldn't do that because we know children all love sweets.
Sweets.
And they'll always eat the sweets. But if you offered a person who was who needed food, who was under, you know, was really hungry,
right.
Those three things, what would they take? The meat.
The meat,
for sure, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You certainly wouldn't take an apple if you were starving. So,
right.
In any case, still, his basic ideas are good. And it would be nice, and he's right about the, that's always been one of the arguments, that it takes so much land for cattle to graze on to get the meat from those cattle when you could grow tons of stuff on that land. Although a lot of this land is not really good for farming anyway.
Yeah.
So, you know, it kind of works out.
Yeah, but that's what he meant about the potato. You know, he said currently we're only using 1% of that 37% of the surface of our country to grow the potatoes, and if we increase that to only 3%, we'd have more than enough food.
We'd have too many potatoes.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So that was his point there. The part about his talk that hit home with me the most was about smoking, when he said, in the same way, the child would never begin to drink or smoke if it weren't to imitate others. And certainly, you know, children see adults smoking, and it's in the old movies, it was presented as something rather glamorous and sexy or whatever. So when you got old enough to sneak a smoke or whatever, then you were glad to start smoking. And
I agreed with him 100% there.
Yeah.
I didn't think about that for a while, and I thought, well, I wonder if anybody would. I suppose there'd be people who'd want to try it if they had ever heard, you know, if it was around, if they had seen it. But mostly it's because you're imitating grown-ups.
That's exactly right.
That's what you're doing.
Sure. And now, I'm not boasting or bragging or anything like that, but that's one habit I never took up, probably because as a child I had asthma problems, and cigarette smoke certainly aggravated that condition, although both of my parents were smokers. And when he says there at the end, where he says, when I go into an inn where people are smoking, within an hour I feel like I've caught a cold, and that's exactly what it would do to me.
Mm-hmm.
It would knock me and my lungs for a loop. So, you know, he and I see eye to eye on that stuff about smoking.
And you love vegetables, too.
Oh, yeah.
And you know what? I think often people know what's best for them. And it's, the thing is, we want other people to take to join us because we think it's good for everybody. But you know, usually it isn't always that way. And lots of times people choose things because it works for them.
Yeah, there you go.
Anyway, well, now we're gonna read about the little dog story.
Mm-hmm. This is very nice. Mm-hmm. The night of the 22nd and 23rd of January, 1942. How many times at Fromelles during the First World War I've studied my dog Foxhole?
Oh, and by the way, I'll just mention that I was on that webpage I was telling you about earlier with the pictures.
Yeah, pictures.
They call the dog Fuchsel, or F-U-C-H-S-L,
mm-hmm.
Fuchsel.
Oh, okay.
And I looked it up, and Fuchsel is fox in German. So they called him Fuchsel, but they've translated it as Foxel, which I think is a good idea because Foxel is a cute name.
Yeah.
And that's what it would be. That's what it is in English.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
When he came back from a walk with a huge bitch who was his companion, we found him covered with bites. We'd no sooner bandaged him and had ceased to bother about him than he would shake off this unwanted load. A fly began buzzing. Foxel was stretched out at my side with his muzzle between his paws. The fly came close to him. He quivered, with his eyes as if hypnotized. His face wrinkled up and acquired an old man's expression. Suddenly he leapt forward, barked, and became agitated. I used to watch him as if he'd been a man. The progressive stages of his anger, of the bile that took possession of him. He was a fine creature. When I ate, he used to sit beside me and follow my gestures with his gaze. If, by the fifth or sixth mouthful, I hadn't given him anything, he used to sit up on his rump and look at me with an air of saying, "And what about me? Am I not here at all?" That is so much like two or three doggies I've had in my life. It's unbelievable. It was crazy how I found I was of the beast. Nobody could touch me without Foxel's instantly becoming furious. He would follow nobody but me. When gas warfare started, I couldn't go on taking him into the front line. It was my comrades who fed him. When I returned after 2 days' absence, he would refuse to leave me again. Everybody in the trenches loved him. During marches, he would run all around us, observing everything, not missing a detail. I used to share everything with him. In the evening, he used to lie beside me. To think that they stole him from me. I'd made a plan, if I got out of the war alive, to procure a female companion for him. I couldn't have parted from him. I've never in my life sold a dog. Foxel was a real circus dog. He knew all the tricks. I remember it was before we arrived at Colmar. The railway employee who coveted Foxel came again to our carriage and offered me 200 marks. You could give me 200,000 and you wouldn't get him. When I left the train at Harpsheim, I suddenly noticed that the dog had disappeared. The column marched off, and it was impossible for me to stay behind. I was desperate. The swine who stole my dog doesn't realize what he did to me. It was in January 1915 that I got a hold of Foxel. He was engaged in pursuing a rat that had jumped into our trench. He fought against me and tried to bite me, but I didn't let go. I led him back with me to the rear. He constantly tried to escape. With exemplary patience, he didn't understand a word of German. I gradually got him used to me. At first, I gave him only biscuits and chocolate. He'd acquired his habits with the English, who were better fed than we were. Then I began to train him. He never went an inch from my side. At that time, my comrades had no use at all for him. Not only was I fond of the beast, but it interested me to study his reactions. I finally taught him everything, how to jump over obstacles, how to climb up a ladder and down again. The essential thing is that a dog should always sleep beside its master. When I had to go up into the line and there was a lot of shelling, I used to tie him up in the trench. My comrades told me that he took no interest in anyone during my absence. He would recognize me even from a distance. What an outburst of enthusiasm he would let loose in my honor. We called him Foxel. He went through all the Somme, the Battle of Arras. He was not at all impressionable. When I was wounded, it was Carl Landshammer who took care of him. On my return, he hurled himself on me in a frenzy. When a dog looks in front of him in a vague fashion and with clouded eyes, one knows that images of the past are chasing each other through his memory.
I like that.
Oh, I do too. I do too.
Now, I wonder if this is... I've never heard of Hitler having dogs when he was a child or growing up. I wonder if this was his first dog or not. He certainly has a feeling for dogs. That's something.
I would think that he probably had a dog or two when he was young, simply because he said he trained that dog. So he had to have some knowledge about animal behavior and how to get this dog to climb that ladder and to teach him how to come back down the ladder. You may be right. That may have been his first one, but I would suspect that maybe if he didn't have one.
Yeah, I would
one,
too.
You know,
I would expect he'd had some dogs around.
Yeah, his neighbors might have or something, you know.
Yeah,
but not
one that was so much his like this one.
Yeah.
And I was shocked to read that this train conductor or whatever stole
him from
him. I didn't know that. I didn't know. I never thought about whatever happened to that little dog. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's funny how people see a dog that looks like a good dog and they want it. People do steal dogs.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And there was nothing he could do about it. What? Anything else you want to say about this part?
No, just that anybody that has owned a dog and loved a dog can really relate to what we just covered. It's really, really touching, you know.
Yes, and you know the thing about what I was saying in the beginning about that person's blog where he was trying to say that this dog didn't really like Hitler. Hitler was trying to pretend like the dog liked him and so on. I mean, they can't stand the idea that Hitler got along with dogs and was animal lover. Mm-hmm. And all the evidence shows that it's true. And they'll do that about Blondie, too, and about everything, Hitler's German Shepherd dogs. They'll say how he somehow mistreated them and he...
Oh, yeah.
So on and so forth. It's just amazing that what such a phenomenon, this anti-Hitlerism.
Yeah, it's just hateful propaganda because, you know, the average Joe is of the opinion that, boy, if a dog doesn't like that guy, nobody could like him. And things like this, you know. And dogs instinctively know when a person is evil and things like that. So, you know, for Hitler to have a dog that loved him and he loved that dog, that goes against their image of him as the devil that they have to portray. So they have to cook up garbage like that to take people away
from
it.
It really is garbage. You'd think they'd be embarrassed.
Yeah.
But, you know, that thing watching for him, you know, he's not exaggerating. I know he's telling the truth.
That's right.
My dog, Polly, she would just, when I had to walk away or she couldn't be right by me, she would sit there and keep her eyes on me. And people would tell me, well, she's watched you the whole time, you know, till I came back again. And when we were in Mexico and we would go to the beach and she didn't like the water, but... when I would go out swimming, she'd be sitting there watching me the whole time. I'd look back at her from out in the water and see she was just sitting there with her eyes on me, you know.
Yep.
And that's the way they do. All dogs do that, I suppose, dogs who have really bonded with you.
Yes.
They do that.
And their loyalty is total.
Absolutely. No matter. Sometimes I left her with friends because I had to travel somewhere and even for a month at a time. And she had some, one was 2 months, and she got along real well, you know, and everybody always loved her, just loved her. I don't know anybody that ever had, took care of her or didn't want to keep her. And then, so she, you know, she adjusted all the time. But as soon as I got back, man, she ran to me and out the door. She's ready to go out the door without looking back. She never cared about those other people once she saw me again. I thought, gee, they were so nice to her. But that's the way she behaved.
Sure.
Huh?
Sure, that's the way it is. But they select their master.
Yeah.
And when they do, that's their master for life. So.
Beautiful thing, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Okay, this next part
I think we're going to have to quit now.
Oh, okay.
Unless
okay.
it's something real short you want to read, we can do it.
Well, we're going to get to this on the next show, Carolyn, but let me just mention one thing in
okay.
it that really struck me, because I even wrote in the margin of my book here, and when he's talking about the Jews, you know, he gets into that again, and, you know, he said, for my part, I restrict myself to telling them they must go away. If they break their pipes on the journey, I can't do anything about it. But if they refuse to go voluntarily, I see no other solution but extermination. And, you know, that's out of context, but when we get to this on the next show. But I just want to tell people, you know, I wrote that, uh-oh, because this is the kind of thing that these hate mongers look for, that say, see there, it proved it right there.
Yeah,
right back there,
yeah.
That he's talking extermination of the poor Jews. And
wow. Well, yeah. I haven't read this part yet. This is I only went through to the foxhole. So I will. We will talk about this next week for sure.
You bet.
And you know, it could be the translation, because that's the whole big question about the words. The German words that were used,
yes.
which were eradication and so on and so forth, you know, that they like to translate as extermination. So I'll have to, I don't know where, we don't, I'll have to see if I can find somebody who's familiar with the original here and see what it says. So
all
good,
right.
Thanks for pointing that out ahead all of right. time, so we'll be prepared for that.
Something to look forward to.
Yes, all right. And
okay.
so this is Carolyn Jaeger and Ray Goodwin, and we're saying good night for the Hitler's Table Talk, and we'll be back next week with you. So thanks for listening, and good night.
Good night, folks.